If you're drawn to the thrill of the chase, be aware of what you're choosing. If you start a relationship with a musician who is constantly on the road, then you can't expect them to give up their career and spend all their time with you. When someone is unavailable, they will generally stay that way. Are you drawn to them because you're looking for someone who is as busy as you are? Or did you grow up with an unavailable parent, so that is the only level of love you think you deserve? To use your karma well, you must be conscious of who you're choosing, why, and whether they fit what you want in your life, as you began to explore in Rule 1. The project. Sometimes a partner needs saving. You are compelled to take care of them, giving them attention, help, and stability. This may play to your nurturing side. In the short term, it makes you feel competent and in control. They need you, and you feel like you can help them live a better life. But in the long term, if they aren't transforming, you feel drained and resentful because you've become that person's caregiver. You're not equals, and you're investing far more in the relationship than they are. Dominating a relationship bolsters our ego and makes us feel important. It doesn't require us to question ourselves or to follow our partner's suggestions. But ultimately, it interferes with the long-term connection we're trying to form. We're attracted to the dynamic rather than the person. If you love the role of guiding, leading, and giving advice, you can find that elsewhere in your life. Try this. Relationship roles. Here are some questions to help you examine what role you played in your most recent relationship or expect to have in a new relationship. Is it what you want? You'll play all the roles I describe, but you want to move toward being supporters of each other while consciously allowing for moments of being fixers and dependent. Type 1. Fixer. Did you find yourself constantly trying to solve, nurture, help, or make the other person better? Were you trying to carry them, trying to make their goals happen for them? Type 2. Dependent. Did you feel like you relied on your partner too much? Did you go to them with all your issues and expect them to find solutions? Type 3. Supporter. Did you like their personality, respect their values, and want to help them toward their goals? Did you respect how they spent their time and kept their space? Or did you always want them to change it? The fixer has a parental mentality. You feel that it's your responsibility to take care of the other person, nurture them. Their happiness is your priority. This mentality can be useful, but it can also go overboard. When you parent your partner, it makes them behave like a child. The dependent has a childlike mentality. You rely on your partner. You want them to figure it all out, and you get upset when they can't solve everything for you. Sometimes we settle into this mentality when we have a domineering partner. It can feel comforting to have someone else take the lead. But we lose out when we don't follow our own path and shape our own lives. The supporter is their partner's champion. You are not a parent, you're not a child. You're side by side with your partner. You're trying to take responsibility, you're trying to develop patience, you're trying to help the other person grow, but you're not trying to micromanage. This is the Goldilocks just right mentality. For a quiz, to help figure out the relationship role that you play, please visit www.relationshiproles.com. It's natural to move in and out of all three of these roles throughout our relationships. Sometimes we take the lead, sometimes we're more comfortable following. What we're trying to avoid is dating a type with whom we're stuck in the same dynamic all the time. Being a full-time fixer means your partner isn't taking their own journey. We don't have the right to take it for them. it's not our role to fix something that may not even be broken. Being fragile full-time means you lack confidence and seek validation from others. You feel broken and want someone to fix you. Being with someone who supports this side of you interferes with you taking responsibility for your own growth, joy, and success. The supporter is an ideal to strive for. Both partners communicate as equals. Your partner is always teaching you, but you're always teaching them. And when you both understand that you're both teaching and learning at the same time, that's when you create a partnership. More on this in Rule 3. The F-boy or F-girl. When we date someone who sleeps around, they are clearly communicating that they aren't interested in an exclusive commitment. If that's what you're looking for, consider whether it's worth staying in it for great sex. Sex can distract us from making good choices about who to be with and whether to stay with them. And one of the biggest causes of that distraction is the hormone oxytocin. According to neuroscientist and psychiatrist Daniel Amen, oxytocin is related to feelings of being in love, and the release of oxytocin can support and even accelerate bonding and trust. Generally, men have lower levels of oxytocin than women, but sex causes men's oxytocin levels to spike more than 500%. New York University neuroscientist Robert Fromke says that oxytocin acts like a volume dial, turning up and amplifying brain activity related to whatever someone is already experiencing. During and after sex, we feel more in love, but it's not actually love. We feel closer chemically, even though we're not closer emotionally. Additionally, the hormone actually has a temporary blocking effect on negative memories. So all of those little things that were bothering you, or that argument you had beforehand, which might have been a major warning sign, could fade after sex. When I interviewed husband and wife relationship experts John and Julie Gottman on my podcast, John said that oxytocin can be the hormone of bad judgment. He says, you keep thinking it's going to be okay, because that hormone makes you feel safe and secure, and you don't see the red flags the person is sending, saying, I'm not trustworthy. If someone makes it clear that they aren't interested in committing, there can still be a fun connection, but know that you aren't likely to learn much from them. The opulent one. The Bhagavad Gita talks about 6 opulences: knowledge, fame, money, beauty, strength, and renunciation. Sometimes we're attracted to someone who has a single opulence, and this is enough to prematurely convince us we're in love. In Beyoncé's song Halo, the light surrounding someone convinces her they're everything she needs and more. Yet someone's halo isn't necessarily an accurate indicator of who they are. In psychology, the halo effect is a type of cognitive bias where we form an inaccurate impression of someone or something based on a single trait or characteristic. For instance, if someone is attractive, we're more likely to assign other positive attributes to them, like intelligence, wit, or kindness. This particular halo effect is called the attractiveness stereotype. One study showed that teachers graded attractive students more favorably when the class was in person, but not when the class was online and the teachers couldn't see the students. Other studies showed that servers deemed to be more attractive made higher tips. When we see a good-looking person, we might make unconscious assumptions that they're wealthier or more ambitious or more likable and so on, and this can influence our attraction to them. The Bhagavad Gita says that the six opulences show us the fallibility of desire. We want attention, but a million likes won't make us feel loved. We want beauty, but we try to make youth, which is not the only kind of beauty, last forever. We want money, but it won't buy happiness. Try Googling lottery winners if you want proof of that. If we look for the opulences in a partner, we are being sold a temporary bill of goods. The Bhagavad Gita says that divine love of God is to know their greatness, but gravitate toward their sweetness. You may know all of your partner's accolades and achievements, but that doesn't define them as an individual. Being attracted to our partners for what they have or what they've achieved is not a bad place to start, but it's not a good place to end. Abilities and achievements don't matter so much as qualities and actions. We make the mistake of assigning qualities to people based on their abilities. We assume that a good communicator will be trustworthy. We think a writer must be thoughtful. A manager must be organized. The only way we can know what qualities a person truly has is by spending time with them and observing them. Only when we know someone intimately and deeply do we find the sweetness in them. Try this. Reflect and learn from a past relationship. We tend to base successes in relationships on how long they last, but their actual value lies in how much we learn and grow from them. If we understand that, we can examine the choices we've made, assess why we picked a person, figure out what went wrong, and develop a better sense of whom to pick and whether we need to change anything for next time. 1. What energy were you in when you chose to be with your ex? Energy of ignorance. In this energy, you might have picked someone because you were bored, because there was nobody else around, or because you were lonely. Choices made in ignorance lead to depression, pain, and stress. Energy of passion. In this energy, you picked someone because you wanted one of the opulences. Decisions made in passion start well, but have to deepen into understanding and respect, or else they end terribly. Energy of goodness. In this energy, you chose someone with whom you felt connected and compatible. There was mutual respect, and often these relationships end with some feelings of respect still intact. 2. Why did it end? Be as honest with yourself as you can when you assess what went wrong in this relationship. 3. Learn from it. What can you think of that you will try to do differently next time? Can you enter your next relationship from an energy of goodness? Can you set aside opulences and look for qualities that make good partners? You attract what you use to impress. The opulences highlight a very practical way of understanding karma. If we are attracted to someone for their ambition, that's what we get, a person whose priority is ambition. There's nothing wrong with ambition, until you realize that you want someone who has lots of time to share with you. Sometimes we feel like none of the options before us are people we want to date. And then we have to ask ourselves, why are these my options? Why are we attracting these people? And how can we attract the ones we want? Again, karma has the answer. If you put something into the world, you get it back. This is karma in its most basic form. If I use money to present myself as valuable, I'll attract someone who believes that money is what makes me valuable. When we present ourselves, we are signaling the dynamic we want, how we expect to be treated, what we think we deserve. I had one client who is a successful entrepreneur. He was upset because every woman he met only wanted him for his money. But every picture he posted in his online profile showed him in a supercar or him in front of another home he'd bought. He said, "I'm not like that in person," but he shouldn't have been surprised that he was attracting a certain type of person. If you use wealth to impress someone, you are committing to whatever it takes to sustain your wealth. But one day, you may want to change how you spend your time. You may want to feel that your partner values you for more than your net worth. If you use your body to impress someone, you are putting yourself in a position where aging is hard to accept. One day, your body will change, and you may want a partner whose love will last for years. If you use your social status to impress someone, you may find that someone with a higher social status is more attractive to your partner. Or something may change your status and you'll want a partner who can support you through a hard time. If you use your intellect to impress someone, you may find that you don't feel an emotional connection. If you use sex to impress someone, you are setting a standard for physical connection that may be hard for one or both of you to sustain if attraction fades. When we put ourselves out in the world, whether it's on a first date, social media, or a dating profile, we are saying, "This is the version of me that I want you to like." It's important to put out the version of yourself that you want someone to be attracted to, as opposed to the version of yourself that you think someone would be attracted to. These are two different things. If you attract someone through a persona, then you're either going to have to fake being that promotable person forever, or they're eventually going to discover the real you. One study showed that 53% of online daters lied in their profiles, women more than men, and more often about looks, doing things like posting an old photo so they looked younger, and men more often about financial status. Considering that men tend to rank physical attractiveness as a highly valued characteristic in a potential partner, and women tend to rank financial success similarly, you can see how that might play out, at least in heterosexual relationships. Even if your self-positioning is more subtle and you're willing to play out the role you've invented indefinitely, you will always know in your heart that you aren't loved for who you really are. You've made them fall in love with a character that you created, not you. By pretending to be someone else, you will attract strife into your life. Save yourself that time and energy. It's natural to want to present the best version of yourself. You may be doing this through the opulences, whether by trying to slip where you went to college into conversation, or taking your date to an expensive restaurant to demonstrate wealth, or uploading your most seductive photos to a dating website. We can easily get caught up in judging ourselves by our net worth or the way we show it in material possessions, our friends or followers, our physical appeal. But we all know people who have high value using these metrics and still have low self-worth. There is a saying that the poor man begs outside the temple while the rich man begs inside it. Or, as Russell Brand puts it, the more that I've detached myself from the things that I thought would make me happy, like money and fame and other people's opinions, the more truth is being revealed. We market ourselves to others using our opulences, but doing that won't benefit us in the long run. We want to show our real personality, values, and goals, so we are loved for what matters most to us. The converse is also true. Be aware if opulences are what attract you to your partner, and beware if they're all that attracts you. You don't want to end up with someone whom you're only attracted to physically or whose social life captivates you or whom you only connect with about work or whose external success compels you. These qualities are tied to temporary situations and characteristics. They won't last, and when they are gone, so is the relationship. When I met Radhi, I had nothing. No, that's not true. What's true is that we've been together ever since all I had to offer her was myself, and that seemed to be enough. Try this. What you showcase. When there's a disparity between what attracts your partner and what you love about yourself, you may struggle to live up to their vision. First, make a list of what you love about yourself. Think about the qualities you're most proud of and try to steer clear of the opulences. Are you kind, caring, hardworking, honest, creative, grateful, flexible, reliable? Now, for each of your long-term or defining relationships, make a list of the qualities you think that person saw and appreciated in you. We want to build relationships where we are loved for what we love in ourselves. What you want from someone else, first give to yourself. Once we have a better sense of the samskaras we've gathered over the years, we can look at how they've influenced our choices and see if we like the results. We don't want to make the same mistakes over and over again. We want to carry the gifts from our past into the present. But we can't assume our partner will receive them exactly as we expect. We don't want to bring gaps to our relationships, expecting our partner to fill them. We want to fill our own gaps. As you observe your partner or potential partner, consider what draws you to them. Is your judgment influenced by outdated criteria from your past? If your parents gave you all their attention, are you expecting that from a partner? Do the movies you saw in your youth have you expecting to be swept off your feet? Was your first love remote and unavailable, so you're stuck in a pattern of repeating that dynamic? One of my clients was getting really angry at his wife when she didn't come home from work on time. I asked him why he was having such a strong reaction, and in the course of our work, he realized that his own mother never came home on time and it had bothered his father. He had inherited his father's anxiety. I asked him what his wife's lateness signified for him. After some thought, he said, "It's like she doesn't care about me and doesn't want to spend time with me." I suggested that he ask his wife about it, and we talked about how instead of saying, "So how come you're always late?" in an accusatory tone, he could ask, "What have you been working on? Is it exciting or stressful?" It turned out that his wife was stressed about a project and that she thought in 3 months' time she'd be able to start coming home earlier. She didn't realize that it would have eased his mind to know about this project and when it might end. But even more important was his realization that the reason for her lateness differed from his interpretation. It wasn't a perfect happily ever after, but he was able to come to terms with the situation instead of enduring his inherited anxiety. He asked for time with her over the weekend, and they figured out how to address both of their needs. Our relationships aren't supposed to be responses to what our parents did and didn't give us, or balms for the insecurities of our youth. If we look to our partners to fill an emotional gap, this puts undue pressure on our partner. We're asking them to take responsibility for our happiness. That's like saying, "I won't drive my car until my partner puts gas in it." Why wait for someone else to make you feel good? And that's why it's so deeply important that we heal ourselves, taking charge of that process instead of shifting blame and responsibility to a partner. If we're trying to fill an old void, will choose the wrong partner. A partner can't fill every gap. They can't unpack our emotional baggage for us. Once we fulfill our own needs, we're in a better place to see what a relationship can give us. Meanwhile, and always, you can give yourself what you want to receive. If you want to treat yourself, you could make plans to go someplace you've never been before, or arrange a birthday celebration for yourself, or dress beautifully for an upcoming event. If you want to feel respected at work, you could decide that you're going to make a list for your own benefit of everything you contributed to a project. We think of feeling appreciated, respected, and loved as core needs in a relationship. But when we attend to these needs for ourselves in small ways every day, then we don't have to wait for our partner to deliver them through a grand gesture. Try this. Give yourself what you want to receive. Fill your own gaps by looking for ways to treat yourself the way you're looking for others to treat you. I never felt appreciated by my parents. If you want to be appreciated, what do you want to be appreciated for? What can you do every day that makes you feel appreciated? I never felt like my parents thought I was special. If you want to feel special, what do you want to feel special for? What can you do every day to make yourself feel special? My parents didn't respect my feelings or opinions. If you want to feel respected, what do you want to be respected for? What can you do every day to respect yourself? These are hard questions, so take your time with them. Answers may not come quickly. Ponder them for a day, a week. You may gradually start to identify recurring negative thoughts that you've carried from your past. If you keep telling yourself, "I'm nobody until someone tells me I'm someone," it will make you more prone to insecurity, stress, and pressure. If you often tell yourself that you're not good enough, you become not good enough. We need to disrupt those negative patterns by developing new thought patterns. It may feel forced or fake, but when you practice these new positive thought patterns, you start living up to them. Check in with yourself. Set aside 3 minutes before you start your day and 3 minutes at the end of your day to make sure you're filling your own gaps. Attaching new habits to the beginning or end of things is natural to us and the best way to bring the behaviors and beliefs we need into our lives. In the 3 minutes you've set aside in the morning, sit by yourself and pick one thing you can do for yourself today to improve your day. It might be deciding to make a lunch date with your friend you haven't seen in a while. It might be showing up at a yoga class or taking no phone calls for the first hour of the morning. To wake up and hope the day will be great is outsourcing the day. Instead, pick just one act you can perform yourself that might change your day for the better. In the last 3 minutes of the day, assess how you felt about the one thing you picked. Did it help your day? Should you try it again tomorrow or choose something else? Expanding our love. Our preparation for love began with two rules guiding us to solitude and self-examination. We began practices to transform loneliness to productive time in solitude. We unpacked our pasts and began to unlock our samskaras so that we can learn from our karma. Whether you're in a relationship, looking for one, or leaving one, these rules help you build and maintain the skills you need for love. By now, you're already better prepared for love than most people. And that opens the door for you to share your love with another person. One of the translators of the Bhagavad Gita, Eknath Ishwaran, said, "Love grows by practice. There's no other way." Now, as we move into the practice of love, we will build our ability to recognize love, define it, develop it, trust it, and if and when we are ready, to embrace love. Write a love letter to yourself. Writing a letter to yourself can help you establish a dialogue with yourself and gain self-awareness about how you're thinking and feeling. This in turn will help you make choices and take the next steps in your life. Dear self, we've been together since the beginning, and it's thanks to you that I get to experience this life. You're closer to me than anyone, the only one who knows all that I've seen and done, the only one who has witnessed the world through my eyes, who knows my deepest thoughts, my darkest fears, and my biggest dreams. We've been through a lot together, everything in fact, the highest highs and the lowest lows. You're with me in my greatest moments and the ones I'd like to do over. And no matter what, you've always stuck by me. We're true partners. You're the only one about whom I can say without a doubt that we will always be together. But in spite of your loyalty and your caring, I've sometimes ignored you. I haven't always listened when you told me what's best for me or nudged me in the direction I should go. Instead of looking to you, I looked outward at what others were doing or saying. I distracted myself so I couldn't hear your voice. Instead of caring for you, I sometimes pushed too hard. And yet, you've never abandoned me. You've always forgiven me, and you've always welcomed me home without judgment or criticism. For all of that, I thank you. Thank you for being gentle with me, for being strong, for always being willing to learn and grow with me through my mistakes and my triumphs, and for over and over reflecting back to me the best of what is inside me. Thank you for showing me what unconditional love truly means. Love me. Meditation for solitude. This meditation is focused on self-love. When we practice love and gratitude for ourselves, we nourish the soil in which love is rooted, and from which love, in its many forms, will grow and blossom. This meditation is best practiced in bed before you go to sleep at night and when you wake up in the morning. Find a comfortable position. Close your eyes if that feels good to you. If not, simply soften your focus. Whether your eyes are open or closed, gently lower your gaze. Take a deep breath in and breathe out. If you find that your mind is wandering, that's okay. Gently bring it back to a space of calm, balance, and stillness. Self-gratitude meditation. Breathe normally and naturally. Take a moment to notice the pattern of your breathing. Allow your focus to shift to your body. Notice where it touches the bed and where it does not. If there's a sheet or blanket on you, notice the sensation where it touches your skin. Now, bring your attention to the soles of your feet. Notice how they feel. Express gratitude to your feet for what they allow you to do. I am grateful for your support. I am grateful for how you ground and connect me to the earth. Use whatever language feels natural and welcome to you. Allow your attention to move upward to your lower legs, your knees, and your thighs. Notice how they feel. Express gratitude to them. Thank you for your steadiness. Thank you for helping me move around in the world. Bring your focus to your arms. Notice your upper arms, elbows, forearms, and hands. Give thanks. Thank you for all you do to help me interact with the world around me, enabling me to care for and express myself. Allow your attention to shift to your face. Notice the nose that lets you smell, the mouth that enables you to eat, the eyes that let you see, and the ears that let you hear. Express your gratitude. I'm grateful for the richness you bring to my life, allowing me to enjoy nourishing food, to hear music, to smell flowers, and to take in the beauty of nature and the world around me. Now take a moment to go inside beneath the skin. Scan slowly downward, starting with your brain. Express gratitude to your brain for all the important functions it is able to perform. Thank you for all you do to coordinate and monitor this miraculous organism that is me, for enabling me to process information, to think, to joke, to appreciate, to feel compassion, and to take action. Lower your focus to your heart. Notice its rhythm as it beats inside your chest. Express your gratitude. Thank you for working all day and all night, whether I appreciate you or not, whether I acknowledge you or not. Shift your attention to your lungs. Notice how your rib cage softly expands and collapses with each breath. Give thanks. Thank you for filling me with life. Allow your attention to drop to your stomach. Notice how it feels. Thank your stomach. I am grateful for how you digest food to create the energy I need for each day. Slowly, shift your focus back out to your whole body. Take a moment to express gratitude to your body or to your mind for whatever stands out to you in this moment. And when you're ready, you can gently and softly open your eyes and just be present. Part 2. Compatibility. Learning to love others. The second ashram, Grihastha, is the stage of life when we extend our love to others while still loving ourselves. This stage introduces the challenges of learning to understand, appreciate, and cooperate with another mind, another set of values, and another set of likes and dislikes on a daily basis. Here we explore the challenges of karma, maitri, loving others. Rule 3. Define love before you think it, feel it, or say it. My boyfriend told me he loved me, and a week later, he fully ghosted me. I told my partner I loved her. She said, "Thank you." I was dating a girl for several weeks. When I told her I thought I was starting to fall in love with her, she said she needed more space. We've been together for 3 years and we say I love you before bed. Same time every night. I'm not sure it means anything anymore. We say I love you, or wait for the right time to say it, or hope someone will say it to us, but there is no universal agreement as to what it means. For some it means, I want to spend the rest of my life with you. For some people, saying I love you means, I want to spend the night with you. Between those two intentions are infinite others, and some of us say it without any particular intention because in that moment, we just feel something we interpret as love. This leaves a lot of room for confusion, miscommunication, and false expectations. Writer Samantha Taylor says, "The first time I told my now husband I loved him, we were spending one of those long nights on the phone early in our dating relationship, back when people actually talked on the phone. Delirious with sleepiness, I told him that I wanted to tell him I loved him, but didn't want to scare him off. 'Don't worry,' he told me. 'Saying I love you isn't a big deal to me. I love my mom, I love my friends, I love you too.' Great, he loved me like his mom. So romantic. He was telling her that his definition of I love you was different from hers. Broad, low pressure, and not particularly romantic. She adds, "Fortunately, he must have grown to love me in a romantic way because we've been married for almost 10 years. We say I love you in so many different contexts, with family and friends and lovers, that it doesn't indicate anything but the presence of some sort of affection. And yet we have expectations based on what we assume it means to the other person. I love you doesn't include commitment. It doesn't promise you want to have children together. It doesn't guarantee that you'll put any effort into making a relationship work. It's a beautiful start, but not a substitute for many other meaningful conversations." A survey showed that men are quicker to say, "I love you," than women, taking an average of 88 days. A whopping 39% of them declare their love within the first month. Women take an average of 134 days, and 23% of them declare their love in month one. It's hard to imagine that people who feel love within weeks actually live up to what their partners think that statement means. You may feel like you know someone because you've spent time with them, and you like their personality, but you may not know their dreams, their values, their priorities, the things that matter to them. You think you know their heart, but you just know their mind. Love takes time. I'm not saying you need to understand someone fully before you fall in love. We're always learning new things about our partner. But too often we leap to love based on a very small amount of information. In any other area of your life, it's very unlikely that you make a big decision based on such a small amount of information. Love is not black and white. You either love someone or you don't. And there's only one way to do it. Some people renew their vows every 10 years, either to recommit to love or to express how their love has evolved. Some people have long-distance love. Some people are friends with benefits. Some people get divorced, but they find a way to parent together peacefully and comfortably. Recently, a guy came up to me at a wedding and told me he just got out of a long relationship. He said, "We love each other, but leaving each other was the best way to carry on loving each other." That's love too. To discount the many forms of love is to miss many beautiful possibilities. Understanding the nuances allows you to define and honor the love you have with the person you're with. As soon as we say, "I love you," we're going to have to live up to those words, not by our definition, but by the definition of the person we love. On the flip side, when we accept someone else's love, we have to realize that they aren't using our definition of love. Before we decide that we're in love, before we tell another person we love them, and before we determine what it means when they say those words to us, we must consider how we define love. What do we expect love to feel like? How do we know we love someone? How do we know if they love us? The only way to avoid miscommunication is to talk about love using far more than those three words. This rule will help us figure out what we mean when we say, "I love you," what it may or may not mean when our partner says it, and how to find a meaning we can share. The four phases of love. When we tell each other we love each other, we rarely elaborate, unless it's to add a romantic flourish, like "so much," or "to the moon and back." It's pretty black and white. We've either declared our love or we haven't. We don't leave much room for variation or degrees of love. But we can take some cues in the practice of love from the Bhakti tradition, an 8th century movement in Hinduism. Bhakti describes the journey of falling in love with the divine in stages. The first stage is Shraddha, where we have the spark of faith that makes us take interest in the divine. Notice how even when we're talking about connecting with the divine, there's a preliminary desire. Curiosity and hope drive us to engage. This leads us to the next stage, sadhu sangha, desiring to associate with spiritually advanced persons. Here we find a spiritual teacher, guide, mentor, who can help us develop our practice. After that is Bhajana Kriya, where we perform devotional acts like attending services and praying. As our devotion gets deeper, we become free from all material attachments, anartha nivritti, achieve steadiness, nishtha, in self-realization, and find enthusiasm, ruchi, for serving the divine. This taste leads us to further attachment, which is called bhava. This is the preliminary stage of pure love of the divine. Then finally, we reach pure love for the divine, prem. This is the supreme stage of life, where we have attained the highest form of a divine loving relationship, unbound by awe and reverence or any kind of hierarchy. Because the bhakti stages of love describe an intimate, direct relationship between a person and their God, they can apply in many ways to how we love each other. So I decided to bring the model down to earth and reinterpret it for the practice of understanding and loving another person. When it comes to love, we expect that we'll know when we know. But our experiences of love can be different at different times. The four phases of love I'm about to describe can all look like love and feel like love, and they are all part of the journey of love. How do you know if you're in love with someone? Love isn't being called every day, or having your chair pulled out for you, or feeling warm and fuzzy when you see someone. Love isn't a purely romantic fairy tale, and it isn't pragmatically checking qualities off a list. Looking at these phases helps us understand love differently, define love for ourselves, and better articulate our feelings of love. At the same time, seeing the levels of love helps us understand why our partner might have a different concept of love than we do. Knowing what phase you're in helps orient you for progress to the next phase, and when you can't see yourself getting to the next phase, then you might enjoy it for a while, but you know that it's not sustainable. We might not progress in exactly this order, and the rest of this book will show you how we cycle back through the phases. This is a cycle we will repeat not just with one partner, but with pretty much everyone who plays an important role in our lives. This is the practice of love. 1. Attraction. 2. Dreams. 3. Struggle and growth. 4. Trust. Phase 1. Attraction. In phase 1, we feel a spark of intrigue, interest, and attraction. This makes us want to figure out if someone is worth our time and effort. Researchers describe what we call love as 3 distinct drives in the brain: lust, attraction, and attachment. When we move from lust to attraction, we're taking the generalized desire to connect with someone and focusing it on a specific person. The brain chemicals involved in lust differ from those that produce attraction. Lust is governed more by testosterone and estrogen, whereas attraction includes dopamine, the reward chemical, and norepinephrine, the brain's version of adrenaline, which when combined with dopamine can generate that feeling of euphoria around the target of our attraction. Additionally, levels of the feel-good hormone serotonin actually drop in this phase, which contributes to our feelings of anxiety and passion in the early stages of attraction. We have an exciting surge of hope and belief that someone could be the right person for us. We feel intrigue and interest. We swipe right. Love often starts with this thrilling hint of possibility. It means, you intrigue me. I want more. Chemistry like this feels amazing, but we should be careful not to think that chemistry is the only way love begins or that it is the entirety of love. Time helps you understand whether what you're feeling is truly love. Think about what it's like when you place an order for a chair on a website. It looks good online. It fits beautifully into a room pictured on your favorite home store site. But when it arrives, it isn't comfortable to sit on. In attraction, we observe people for how they appear, but we don't understand what it's like to have a relationship with them. I used to know this guy who came up to me every month and told me he had fallen in love with another girl, someone he'd bumped into or met on Instagram. For a week, he'd be completely infatuated. And then a few weeks later, it would be someone else. In the attraction phase, we have glimpses of love that show us its beauty. Lingering in the attraction phase is pleasurable. With new people, we've carefully exposed what we want them to see, our best features. There are few arguments, expectations, and disappointments. We can sustain the fantasy of a perfect match, but it takes a deeper connection to go beyond phase one. Science supports the idea that having deeper connections bodes well for relationships. Professor Matthias Mell at the University of Arizona in Tucson and his team studied whether the conversations we have affect our well-being. Specifically, they were looking at the difference between small talk and having deep, meaningful discussions. They had 79 participants wear recorders for 4 days while they went about their daily lives. The devices were designed to record snippets of ambient sound, netting about 300 recordings per participant over the 4 days. The researchers then listened to the recordings and noted when the participants were alone or talking with others, and when their conversation was superficial, "What do you have there? Popcorn? Yummy." Or deep, "She fell in love with your dad? So did they get divorced soon after?" The researchers also assessed participants' well-being through a series of statements, such as, "I see myself as someone who is happy, satisfied with life." They found that higher rates of well-being were associated more with people who had deep conversations than those who made more small talk. Going deep isn't a technique. It can only be a genuine experience that leads to a true connection. But we can examine our own willingness to open up and be vulnerable with people as we build trust with them. Social scientists say that vulnerability leads to reciprocal escalating self-disclosure. What this means is that over time, a couple begins to reveal vulnerabilities to each other. That's the self-disclosure. Sharing parts of yourself doesn't mean bearing your whole soul all at once. Sometimes, when we are caught up in the moment, we're tempted to do that. But if we gradually unveil our personalities, values, and goals, we start to see if there is a connection. Letting yourself be vulnerable with this intention keeps you feeling protected. Like you aren't exposed too much, too fast to a person you can't trust. If it all goes well, you reveal increasingly intimate facets of yourself at a pace where you feel comfortable. That's where the escalating comes in. And the disclosure is a gift that you give back and forth to each other. That's reciprocal. It is with reciprocal escalating self-disclosure that we start to truly know a person. The three-date rule. In my experience working with clients, 3 dates usually provide enough time to determine if you and another person would be a good match. These 3 dates don't have to be your first 3 dates, and you don't have to do them one after another. You can spread them out. Sometimes it's nice to just see a movie. In these dates, you'll focus on 3 areas. Whether you like their personality, whether you respect their values, and whether you would like to help them achieve their goals. For simplicity's sake, I'm going to suggest focusing on these qualities sequentially, 1 per date. But you'll probably be uncovering some aspect of each dimension during each date. First, we start with personality because it's the easiest thing to spot, understand, and connect with. In their personality, you'll see how their past has shaped them. Second, you'll explore their values, which define who they are today. And third, you'll try to recognize their goals, which encapsulate what they want in the future. Date 1. Do you have fun together? Do you enjoy each other's company? does conversation flow? What makes you comfortable and what makes you uncomfortable? The first day is to find out if you really enjoy each other's personalities. To do so, you need to shift between small talk and deep talk. The topics we gravitate toward, favorite movies or vacation plans, don't help us know people deeply. Instead, you can start to ask questions that inspire both of you to reveal more personal details, including your quirks and imperfections. Remember, we share vulnerabilities gradually as we get to know and trust each other. So on this date, your focus is to see if you enjoy and appreciate their personality. Try to learn something new about them or see a side of them you haven't seen. Here are some light questions you can ask on date one. You'll see that they are questions about taste and preferences. They tread in areas where most people are comfortable, but they create the possibility to show real passions. When you ask someone what the best meal they ever had was, the question isn't just about food. It opens up a bigger conversation about where and when they had the food and what made it special.